are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, August 7th, 2017. My name is Michael Brooks, and I'm Michael Monday, and this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America. Downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Murtaza Hussein of The Intercept. What's the state of the Syrian multi-party civil war? Who are some of the Shia groups that are fighting ISIL? Carla Del Ponte of the UN Human Rights Commission investigating Syrian war crimes. She's quitting after 5 years focusing on Syria, throwing her hands up. We're also talking about what is and what isn't the deep state, as theories about it and its supposed conflict with the Trump administration proliferate, ceding to alt-right nonsense and dumb-dumb left alliances. All that and more with Murtaza Hussein. Mike Pence, it's fake news. He is not laying the groundwork for running in 2020. But how long before, Mike, I don't know. I feel like you're loyal, but not loyal.
I wish I could say I was surprised, Mike.
The furious scramble as the Trump administration implosion continues. Democrats a few steps forward, but several steps backward. We're looking specifically at the jobs component of this supposed better deal. Exhausted, discredited neoliberal ideas continue to lurk. And genuine left progressivism and alt-center neoliberal nonsense already coming to a fever pitch battle as the relative merits of 2020 candidates are debated. Eric Bolling, shockingly, was part of a system of rampant sexual harassment and abuse at Fox. Like Roger Ailes, I would be genuinely shocked if somebody told me that Eric Bolling had not sent unsolicited pictures of his penis out. But it seems like he probably did. Jeff Flake is out spinning his new conscience of a conservative garbage. Basically, there should be a Koch brothers agenda of entrenching poverty, massive class disparities, and handing the country over to corporations. But we should be a little bit more polite about it and maybe use racial divisions more subtly versus overtly, says the boring John McCain of 2017. All that and more on today's Majority Report. The At Michael Brooks Show debuts tomorrow night. We're streaming live at 7 p.m. on YouTube. And then what's going to happen is that the public version of the show will be released on iTunes on Wednesday. It will live on YouTube as a full show. I'm having crew member the brilliant Hannah Guys in studio with me, along with, of course, super producer Matt Leck. I think David Slavik will be stopping by. Thank you. Who's also a producer on the new show. You're going to basically, the public version of the show is going to have an opening and then a commentary from me. We're going to throw somebody in the pyramid. We're going to take some of your calls, and Hannah and I are going to go over some stories. Then we're going to the post game, which is specifically stories that have been curated and contributed by members of the show that they want us to cover. That will be the first member show, which will also be released on Wednesday. So there'll be a public version released on Wednesday, a members version released on Patreon, a public version released on iTunes on Wednesday, a members version released on Patreon on Wednesday. And then over the weekend, the first history primer is going to be on the Modern Third Way where it came from, its heyday in the 1990s with Clinton, Blair, and Gerhard Schroeder, but how it still lives today in Emmanuel Macron, in the alt-center, and in the shrunken horizons of center-left politics. But I'm going to give more of, there's going to be, you know, clips from Clinton and Blair actually talking about it. There's going to be a real anchoring in historical research from a researcher, Atkins at York University, and some other sources. And really the fact that, you know, in the 1990s, they actually were attempting to replace the International Socialist Organization with the International Third Way Organization. It's a good kind of anchoring in where a lot of the things that we're still living with come from. And that's the sort of thing that we want to do with the show. And that, of course, will be for members. I'm going to ask people, and we are at 434 members, so thank you. Amazing response, and it's allowing us to do it. And also we had our first Discord chat for members over the weekend. That went great. And all the other features are going to get wheeled out too, including for people on different levels, like the monthly phone call and everything else. If you aren't a member, but even if you are a member, I'm going to ask that you do the same thing where you go to the iTunes when the public show is released and, you know, game up that system. Give it reviews, download it, shoot us to the top of the public charts, because we want the public version of the show to go as far and wide as possible while giving all of the premium, extra, and curated content for the amazing members that make the Michael Brooks Show possible. So thanks a million. I appreciate it immensely. Debuting tomorrow at 7 p.m. Hannah Guy's in studio. Anoa Changa calling in. Wozni Lambre calling in. Corey Pine calling in. And of course, not calling in tomorrow, but Bhaskar Sunkara and crew. Alona Miskai on crew as well. Super excited about it. Thank you, everyone. The response has been amazing. We're going to work like hell to put out a great show for you. Speaking of working like hell, Kellyanne Conway is... I don't know if she's the original Trump whisperer, but she is someone who, through all of these iterations of this horrific national debacle, this sort of dumb, aspiring apartheid, Kadilo East European dictatorship government we're living under, with this clown fascist jackass and a complacent plutocrat class and Republican Party. Kellyanne Conway has set the direction. She knows how to calm Trump down. She knows how to give him directions. And we just found this little clip from this past weekend on The Week. And right here, there's a couple of things going on here, which is, of course, Kellyanne Conway is, of course, speaking directly to Trump because all he does is watch TV, even though he's really busy and doesn't have time. That was part of his whiny tweet tirade over
the
weekend.
Hardly any time to watch TV.
Hardly. I'm just so immersed in like the issues and such. He's such an airhead. And this is Kellyanne Conway using Trump's favorite form of being babysat, television, to actually give him a little bit of tough medicine. But it's just funny because this is the sort of one of the more kind of raw, direct examples of how the president takes in information and why Kellyanne is still where she is.
I would note, too, in some of the polling, which, of course, I scour daily on behalf of the president, his approval rating among Republicans and conservative and Trump voters is down slightly. It needs to go up. They are telling him, just enact your program. Don't worry about a Congress that isn't supporting legislation to get big ticket items done. And don't worry about all the distractions and diversions and discouragement that others who are still trying to throw logs in your path are throwing your way. Focus on the agenda. And he's doing that.
So that means basically focus on doubling down on xenophobia, on racism, on homophobia, on transphobia. So what can come out of the executive branch, and already has, obviously, is all sorts of executive rulings to gut, destroy the environment, hand over public lands to corporations, reverse protections for lower-income workers, and all of, again, as always, I always use the word, slight, modest progress in some of these areas under Obama. And then the other area is get Stephen Miller out there, support the RAIN Act and everything else, and double up on that core racial xenophobic message. And, you know, that is the sense in which the Trump presidency fits into a chronic history of American capitalist class using white identity politics to divorce white people from class politics, and to create these sort of cornucopias so there aren't multiracial class-based alliances. That's actually the bigger picture that it fits in. And we can look forward to a lot of it. It's good, of course, that the destruction of healthcare didn't happen, but the double up and the attacks on everybody from transgender soldiers to Mexican immigrants to certainly Muslims is only going to be amplified, along with the genuine and true neo-Confederate agenda that Jeff Sessions has over at Attorney General. So that's how the message gets delivered and the message gets received in the insane tweets and the policy directives. And Republicans are still mostly on board of this. And to the extent that there's any pushback, it's just because the legislative agenda has been stymied somewhat. But, of course, the next ticket item is a massive systemic regressive tax cut, which might not have been as ambitious as the first version they were planning if they were able to get rid of healthcare, but it will still be quite ambitious. So keep all hands on deck, see how it fits together, and we will be right back with Murtaza Hussein on the Majority Report.
City play Monopoly with real cash. Me and Biggie and the models be shaking Ace and Diddy and Parada B. Something you cats got to see and the watches be all types of shapes and stones. Being broke is childish and I'm quite grown. Run up in a club with the ice on, me and Pies on. Scope the spot out, see something nice and I'm gone. You cats is home screaming the fights on. I'm in the 1500 seats watching Tyson. Same night, same fight. One of us cats ain't playing right. I let you tell it. People, place yourselves in the shoes of two felons and tell me you won't fall every chance you get. At any chance you hit, we live for the moment. Makes sense, don't it? Now make dollars. Cats pop bottles, bone chicks that favor our dollars and rack up frequent flight mileage.
Gotta let it show.
Magnums, why jig it back something? Watch platinum, got jet lag from flights back and forth, pop corks are the best grapes, make the best CDs and the best tapes. Don't forget the vinyl. Take girls, break spinals. Biggie B, Richie like Lionel. You seen the Jesus, dip the H classes, ice project off lights, chick flashes, blind and broke. Even got rocks in the beard, mustaches, rock top fashions. Ain't change, except the number after the dot on the range. Way you look at me now, kinda strange. I hate y'all too, rather be in Caribbean sands with Rachel. It's unreal. Out the blue, Frank White got to peel. Used to go ill, still toe still. Trying to see 5 mil off the single, for real. You ain't phasing the amazing. While your guns raising, mine is blazing. See you on, see me on, talking to sweetness. Take it for weakness and leave quick.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Murtaza Hussein. He's a journalist and foreign policy analyst with The Intercept. Murtaza, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
It's always a pleasure to be talking with you, Murtaza. And there's, as always, a lot to get to. I just want to touch briefly before we get to the wider picture, but Carla Del Ponte has quit her UN role investigating war crimes in the Syrian conflict, and her brief was to investigate the crimes of all sides and to kind of document and hopefully in the long term hold all factions accountable for human rights abuses. She's basically thrown her arms up and says that 5 years in, the job is useless. And I just wanted to get your thoughts on that. It's a depressing way to start, but necessary.
Yeah, it's unsurprising in some ways because it seems at the start of the conflict, or before it even was a conflict, when it was a revolution, it would be an opportunity to bring to account crimes which have been committed even in decades before the uprising started. Unfortunately, the conflict is sort of hardened to a proxy war. There's a fog of war, which makes getting reliable information more difficult than usual.
Mm-hmm.
And there are whole swaths of the country which are either completely off limits, they're too dangerous to go to do investigations, or they're in control of either the government or groups which don't allow any independent investigations to happen. They can tightly control any access. So actually attempting to, at least now, the way things are today, conduct investigations on war crimes, very frustrating task, and it's not surprising that she would resign and think that her time is better spent on something else.
So you have a recent piece out. You've been kind of documenting a couple of different sort of recent things happening in Syria. One is and Iraq as well, and one is kind of additional U.S. airstrikes and military activity there, and lack of acknowledgement from the part of the administration, the U.S. government, of basically civilian casualties that we're responsible for. And this happens in a kind of broader context of a real escalation of these types of strikes in many different conflict zones, and a kind of major spike in civilian casualties. And then you've also been writing and looking at more specifically some of the Iranian-backed militia groups that are our, again, essentially, at least we're synchronized in opposing IS in Syria with them. But first, I'm wondering if you could just touch on the civilian casualties component, and then we'll get to the broader militia conversation.
I think since the election since the Donald Trump administration came into power in January, there's been a pronounced spike in reported civilian deaths from U.S. airstrikes. And part of this could be attributable to the fact that the IS campaign, the anti-IS campaign, has moved into urban territories over the last few months. So mm-hmm. In Iraq, that'll be Mosul. In Syria, that'll be Raqqa. But even despite this, there is a clearly documented and reported what seems to be loosening of standards around airstrikes when it comes to civilian targeting. And this is very much in line with what Trump and other officials in his administration have said that they would do, that they would increase the brutality in the they would roll up IS more quickly and more brutally than had been done before. And we're seeing this manifest in spiking civilian casualty reports in both countries. There's still a battle going on for Raqqa at the moment, which is still in its midst. And we're getting daily, very regular reports of civilian casualties, which have not really gotten reported, and we're trying to do some more follow-up stories about that. So that's one component of what's going on. And I think that, although Mosul has fallen, the battle against IS is not even close to being done. And when it is done, not clear what political situation will be in place that prevents it from coming back in, because this came about in the first place because of misgovernance and corruption and other failures of governance. So it's we could be very much in the early stages of this conflict.
Okay, so that leads us to specifically some of this work on getting into the actual details of now in Syria, but this does in fact have implications for Iraq, because as you kind of alluded to at Mosul, part of the reason initially that IS found a foothold in Iraq, maybe even more so than Syria, was very directly attributable to, a significant number of Sunnis who had no desire for the fanaticism and the sort of ferocious, grotesque brutality of IS. But in the same way that maybe, and this is there are distinctions, but in the same way that the kind of mythology of how the Taliban came to power in Afghanistan in the mid-90s involved a lot of people who had no interest in the brand of, ultra-literalist fanatical Islam that the Taliban was promoting, but that they perceived the Taliban as, lacking in corruption, providing a sort of clean way forward and being opposed to warlordism. So similarly in Iraq, there was enough Sunnis that felt repressed and marginalized by a Shia government, and they were, that they thought, okay, let's take a bet on IS. So that was certainly part of it. And then in Syria, you know, well, maybe you could set the table a little bit for Syria, because and explain once again, I think it's very important, even though we've done this before, to really delineate the phases of this, because it did start as a genuine democratic revolutionary uprising against a brutal and, in fact, quite right-wing Assad regime, which I'd like you to describe as well. We're at a point now where almost some of the, what I, you know, the kind of tanky narrative has almost become a self-fulfilling prophecy in some respects, that it is a proxy war, and that a lot of the Sunni opposition at this point militarily is dominated by fairly fanatical groups. But that in some ways was self-selected both by the Gulf states that chose to dump money and weapons along with our support, as they usually do in more right-wing fanatical groups, and then by actually Assad opening up his prisons and picking his own opposition.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I think that when you're looking at the way things are in 2017, it's important not to just select what's going on today as being the beyond all and end all of the whole situation. And I think it's very, personally, I think that the reason that the government bears most of the blame for what's happened is that in 2011, 2012, 2013, they could have, you know, there was a very broad cross-sectarian opposition. There was huge civil opposition, and if the government instead had negotiated or acquiesced to a democratic process in the country people were asking for, none of this would have happened. There would not have been the rise of extremism. There would not have been a proxy war in the first place, and the country wouldn't have been destroyed. And the government, as you said, it's an extremely right-wing government, which has governed Syria as basically a family property for several decades. They, instead of negotiating or promising to share power, they decided to very brutally respond to these protests. And they deliberately employed sectarianism as a way to divide people and to exacerbate divisions, because that was the only way that they could have any legitimacy to govern. Other than that, there's not really anything legitimizing them. And a lot of people, understandably today, view them as the only insurance for minorities who are threatened by extremist right. groups. It's true, but that was specifically, it was designed that way because they have no other way of offering themselves as legitimate. They wouldn't have anything to stand on besides that. So, you know,
but
now,
it might
today,
be functionally true now, which is depressing.
I think it is. They had a very brutal and insane strategy of, I wouldn't say insane, it's a very clever actually strategy of attacking certain groups and leaving certain other groups under their protection, or at least attacking them less. Right. And they succeeded in manufacturing divisions. And now, you know, I would say that after 6 years of some of the worst fighting since World War II, there's this element of social Darwinism when it comes to these groups. Like, who the toughest, nastiest people survive in these right. circumstances? Other everyone else either flees or is killed or disappears into prison. So what's left are these, for the most part at least, these Salafi jihadist groups who are still fighting, because they're the ones who are, you know, they can survive in these circumstances. A lot of other people weren't able to. But I think that, you know, it's very, the ruling ideology of the government is just, we're going to govern at all costs, the country belongs to us. And whatever we have to do to ensure that, we'll do it. If it means destroying the country, dividing everyone else, and ruining the social fabric, that's fine. There's a very interesting interview that I think people should read. It was with Anthony Shadid. At the start of the conflict, very way back 2011, with this guy named Rami Makhlouf, who is a Syrian businessman very close to the government, one of the richest people in Syria. He gave an interview to Anthony Shadid, and it was in the New York Times at that time. He said that don't put any pressure on the government, because you don't know what's going to happen if this government leaves, and no one's going to be safe, including Israel. He said that we will govern, we don't want, nothing's going to change. And he very categorically said, more or less, it will destroy the country if anyone tries to make a share power. And they basically just succeeded in doing that. So I do think that they've sort of have de facto, as you said, ensured their future, either by both they've legitimized it. They have a purpose now for staying around, and they've also invited many other countries into Syria so that they can maintain their prerogatives. But I think that it's important to look at things in the whole context, not just a snapshot of a few months or a few years at the end right here.
Absolutely. So then that's a good – tell us about these, you know, Iranian militias. I think that there's an understanding here, and, you know, if there's any group that one could sort of roughly overall at least have some kind of instinctual sympathy for at this point, it would be Kurdish fighters. You know, I know, again, I know some people because they receive some support from the United States that they have that kind of, you know, well, of course you can't support, you know, Kurdish anarchists because in a war situation, they're, you know, accepting backing from who they can get backing from. I think that that's a ludicrous position. But I also know that, you know, like everybody else there, they're not to be idealized. But there's a lot of other factions fighting there, including, you know, when people talk about Iran being on the ground, I think it's less clear what that means. Like with Russia, it's very clear. Russia's, you know, conducting and has conducted a really brutal air war there and has some special forces and other people kind of supporting the Syrian government. But what Iran basically means, the deployment of not just groups like Hezbollah, but a variety of very effective militia groups that are, in fact, you know, putting these sort of like ironic positions of, you know, Trump last week with the, or a couple weeks ago with the lesbian, with the Lebanese prime minister saying, we're at the forefront of the fight. You know, Lebanon's battling Hezbollah and ISIS. And of course, there's, you know, Hezbollah's in Lebanon's government and Hezbollah is actually defeating ISIS on the ground right now. Get us into those groups, those Iranian groups and who they are and how long do they kind of stick around and, you know, what's the sort of next phase of them? And are they as effective at defeating ISIS as they seem to be?
Yeah, and, you know, I want to also mention the what you mentioned about the Kurdish groups, how they receive U.S. support.
Yeah.
And I think that the attacks against them for that reason are very misguided in some ways because, you know, we sort of have this, because the U.S. does, you know, it's responsible for a lot of havoc and bloodshed around the world. We tend to resort to this framework where just opposing anyone receiving support from the U.S. is a fulsome position. But I think this is a very complicated conflict. There are people who, it's very complicated, and there are many different factions who are having to take support from the U.S. because there's no one else there. It's a pragmatic decision. There were some Syrian Arab factions who did it. There were the Kurds who did it. And you know, we have to engage with this subject with a bit more complexity. Regarding the Iranian groups, and, you know, in many ways what's happened in Syria has been a disaster for Iran because it's hurt their regional standing. It's hurt the standing of the popularity of groups like Hezbollah, which were extremely popular throughout the Arab world before the Syrian conflict. But in another way, you know, they have managed to take advantage of chaos which has happened in the Middle East, some of it which was responsibility of the United States, because it was the United States which destabilized Iraq, and now Iran is trying to stabilize it in a way which is favorable to their interests. And it's sort of a logical thing to do. Their fortunes are rising throughout the Middle East because of others' failures for the most part. And in Syria, like, you know, there's a very good logic for both the Iraqi government and the Iranian government to support Bashar al-Assad now. It's not necessarily because they love him. Nouri Maliki, specifically in 2009, blamed Assad for sending al-Qaeda terrorists into Iraq to conduct bombings there. They don't like this guy. He's been sort of either pragmatic ally or very low-key hostility with him. Mm. But now, you know, when he needed them, they saved him. And then by saving him, they basically own him now because he can't govern without their support in the future. And if they pull their support, he could be gone very quickly. So Syria in the future, its sovereignty will be a lot less now. It'll be basically mortgaged to Russians and Iranians and Iraqis and others. And it won't be what it was anymore. It's no longer possible. And Bashar al-Assad will stay in power and you'll still have his mandate and you'll still have many of the perks and benefits of being in power for him and his immediate circle, but functionally, there's no way that he can maintain. He has to govern with the support, critical support of the people around him, of the countries around him, and Russia. And Iran is, in the long term, it could gain a lot from that. It could become a regional power. And it's on the way to becoming that. And I think it's not so much the fact that they're so cunning or nefarious, although they are, they did behave very competently in many ways. It's because decisions which are made in the region to destabilize things have allowed them to take advantage of that. And they're doing so. And I don't see how anyone's going to roll that back without another huge war, which would be against the interests of everybody.
So, you know, I think another thing that's also been hard in terms of understanding this conflict is that it is, I think, you know, for a fair amount of people, the objectives are relatively clear. I think, you know, Israel, obviously, there is some sense of some type of stability coming out of Syria under Assad. I think in the United States, the response in the beginning was, you know, was ambivalent. You know, there was a notion too. I mean, don't forget that up until, you know, very recently, I mean, relatively speaking, before 2011, I mean, there were senior U.S. officials visiting Assad. Assad got, you know, got when he first came into power and inherited the leadership from his dad. You know, he got some of the sort of, you know, this guy is a Western trained physician, blah, blah, blah sort of thing. He's implementing reforms, which of course meant actually just, you know, the sort of fascistic political structure with enhanced neoliberalism and inequality, which was what Assad was practicing. But I guess the interests of Iran is clear. They need, you know, there's this broader strategic perspective that you're talking about, but it's also as simple as, you know, Syria is the transit point to their relationship with groups like Hezbollah and Lebanon. They need a way to maneuver in Syria. You know, Russia has its own sense of diminished spheres of influence and wanting to reassert itself in, you know, areas that it perceives as its proxy and its places. And then, of course, you know, it seemed like the Gulf states basically saw this as an opportunity to basically just, you know, implement some type of pliant Sunni regime. And obviously they don't have any, you know, concern for rights of minority groups or pluralism. But one of the problems with this sort of, you know, conspiracy narrative is I have never been really clear. I mean, like when we invaded Iraq, the desire to invade Iraq and the commitment to cook the intelligence to fit the narrative for that invasion was extremely clear and sort of, you know, coherent. In Syria, it seemed like you had factions in the United States and people policy-wise United States. I mean, I've known people who, you know, off the record have said to me, like, yeah, we should just let Assad clean it up. I don't think that that was a particularly off-the-grid position in the United States at all. Then you had the Obama administration sort of oscillating between its kind of realist instincts and then this kind of concern about human rights, and then that showed up with the chemical weapons usage. And then, you know, there is the kind of ridiculous impulse of kind of a pliant corporate U.S. media that anytime the president bombs somebody, they're being presidential. So, you know, there was that grotesque spectacle of supporting Trump, you know, unleashing some cruise missiles a couple of months ago. But I guess my point being that there's this narrative that on our sort of circles of the left, when there actually is a much more aggressive imperialist intervention from Russia and Iran than from the United States in this particular conflict. And it's not exactly clear what the U.S. strategy or kind of client state interest is. It seems like why couldn't it be just as well served by Assad staying in power as anybody else? And that seems to be now with the official, you know, closing of support for rebel groups that the Russia and the United States have just agreed to, that's kind of where we are. I mean, what is the U.S. position in all this?
Yeah, I think it's been that way for a couple of years. I think that there, you know, the U.S. did intervene in Syria, but it was very strange intervention. In Iraq, they were hell-bent on intervening and deposing Saddam and promoting regime change. In Syria, it's kind of like, Obama was doing everything he could to avoid it. Like when the chemical weapons attack happened in 2013, he was desperate to get out of it, and the Russians sort of gave him a way out. They want Assad to stay in power because he, for many years, he kept stability regionally. And what that means is he didn't let Syrian territory be used for attacks against Israel. He helped the CIA's torture program in 2000, in the 2000 under Bush. Right. He was one of the rendition sites with Assad Syria. And he offered some sense of predictability regionally. And there were some divergent views, but that was the main one. So I think there's a way, if you have to think about imperialism working in, it works in different ways now, like especially in this new century, is that the easiest way of doing it, the most low-cost way, is not going in and imposing a new regime by force. It's having compliant local despots who carry out your policies and whatever else they do, as long as it doesn't get on your toes, it's fine.
Right.
And I think that with Bashar al-Assad, he plays that role very well, and he knows to play that role. Syria has always sought rule for itself under his regime in this broader imperial system. And, you know, there was a perception of him being a moderate or sort of a reformer, and it wasn't just shared by the United States. A lot of people had that view. I think that when the uprising started, there was a lot of hope that he would respond in a better way, and even including among many Syrians. I know many Syrians who didn't even believe until 2013 that he himself was directing the crackdown. They thought that people around him who were bad, and he's being influenced, and he would do differently if he had more power, but I think that view has changed a lot now. And, you know, it's kind of clear that what could happen is he could stay in power for the rest of his life, and he could pass power down to his son.
Right.
Because I think that besides behind all this Republican rhetoric, and even somehow this extremely right-wing regime has managed to co-opt leftist rhetoric somehow, this has become a monarchy. What kind of republic is passed down from a father to son in the first place? It's not that's a ruling family dynasty. It does not exist normally. There are not any elections in Syria. There are no real elections. They're just rubber stamp sort of processes.
Where did this narrative come from that he was some type of... So just to make a distinction, I think, and I mean, you and I might be slightly, I don't know, genuinely, but like I have been almost entirely consistently opposed to almost all of our, you know, at least airstrikes and direct military interventions in Syria, right? And I've also been someone who said, you know, when Hillary Clinton ran around talking about, you know, creating a no-fly zone, that's not this antiseptic thing that it sounds like. Although at the same time, the notion that a no-fly zone in Syria would lead to a global war with Russia is delusional and stupid fear-mongering. But it would kill a lot of civilians, and it might not achieve an objective. At the same time, I have no doubt that, you know, of course Bashar al-Assad is a horrific war criminal and no paragon of any type of global resistance to any type of hegemony. So how has in the discourse those two things have become conflated, even to the point now where some people on the, you know, supposed left actually use war on terrorism discourse? I guess if Russia's doing a war on terror, it's okay, but not us.
Yeah, I mean, that's very surprising to see that, to be honest with you, because this war on terror discourse was created by the United States, and it's a discourse which is very favorable to hegemonic states in the first place, because,
right,
you know, you just call anyone you don't like a terrorist. If they don't have state power, they are deemed illegitimate, and regardless of the specifics of who they might be, any measure which you use against them becomes justifiable. You know, it's been very troubling to see that come about, because that's not a very principled position, and it's not accounting for, this is a very complicated conflict, probably the most complicated conflict in that region since maybe Lebanon in the 80s. But Russia is an imperial power too. It always has been. It had a brief moment with the collapse of the Soviet Union when it was thrown into disarray. It may have become more a regional power. But historically, it's always been an imperial power, especially in the Middle East. And now they're back. And now they're doing the same thing as the United States is doing with equal or greater ferocity. And I think that we have to oppose that. We can't just say that whoever is against the United States or seems to be against the United States, because I don't think there is really great opposition between any of these parties. They're all more or less on the same side.
I think they're totally synchronized. Yeah, right.
I totally agree. There's some play rhetoric about opposition, especially from the Syrian government, which is totally comical. But ultimately, they're on the same side. They've been working together for quite some time. And they antagonize each other on some level, but ultimately the goals are the same. its authoritarian stability in the Middle East. And lost within that are that, you know, how this all got started or what the ultimate goals are. It just becomes focused on what these major powers are doing. And I think that's a view which ultimately ignores the aspirations of the people and the history of what's happened here. The history is extremely important in order to judge the justness of whatever comes next.
And it's just a test site to like flex and show how real you are in terms of your politics on social media in the United States and Europe versus any type of kind of, you know, serious engagement with all these various factions. And then I have one final question, but I just also want to add, not only are they basically synchronized with the Trump, you know, at least with Obama, again, I think certainly starting in 2014, you at the very least kind of informally were, I mean, the attention was turned almost entirely from Assad to IS. So you're already kind of, and I'm not even, you know, right or wrong, that was the alignment. Although we need to always remember that Assad has still been responsible for far more civilian deaths than IS. Then, but at least under Obama, you could potentially connect that to, okay, if Iran and the United States are potentially see eye to eye on the danger of groups like IS and Al-Qaeda, and that fits with a nuclear deal and potentially other openings, that might have ancillary benefits for progressive movements in the Middle East. But with the Trump administration, you simultaneously have a fervent desire to undermine the nuclear deal, almost, I think, search for a pretext for war with Iran, but then at the same time get back to divvying up the imperial spoils with Russia. It's the worst of all worlds. And I don't understand how people don't see that pattern.
Exactly. It's the absolute worst. There's nothing good about two major imperial powers in the world getting together to make a deal or to carve up other parts of the world. That's not a progressive position. That's old school imperialism. It's like going back to pre-World War I era style imperialism. So, I mean, I think that should be, opposing that should be a primary goal of any progressive movement or primary objective. I don't see Putin and Trump getting together as a great victory for peace. I think it's a great disaster for whoever they're talking about dividing up, whatever country they're trying to impose some plan on. I think that's opposing that should be the quintessential objective of any progressive movement. And I think that, I think you very well could see a war between the United States and Iran. I think that'd be a disaster for Americans, Iranians, and anyone else caught in between that. And I mean, within that, I think that it's actually, it's been sort of depicted as Bashar al-Assad will be a way if Russia and Iran and the United States to sort of agree and move forward. But I don't think so. I think that you might end up with Assad and a war against Iran. You might end up with all these things happening simultaneously. And I think it's actually in the benefit of the Syrian government that these divisions continue, because the way that they survived was by exploiting a division which existed between the United States and Russia. They managed to play that off very smartly to their own benefit. And if that division actually, over at least that subject, went away, they could theoretically dispose of him in some diplomatic process. But there has to be some low-level, at least perception of rivalry over the subject. And regardless of what happens on the ground, that could still continue. But I think it's very important to watch what they actually do in the next few years, because it could be very disastrous. And I really think that these conflicts are just at their beginning. They're not winding up anytime soon. They're just getting started.
Final question, Murtaza. And this is connected because the whole time that this has been happening, there has been these, you know, ongoing not necessarily ongoing, but different stages of supposed negotiations happening in Geneva. And, you know, it's another, there was a, this is a broader project that I'm working on for the new show, but there was this conversation that the former South African president, Thabo Mbeki, had on Al Jazeera several years ago with Mike Hanna, who I've had on this show, is a very good journalist, on sort of this notion of the ICC, International Criminal Court, and does justice trump peace, in the sense that does kind of Western priorities for punishing certain bad actors, specifically in this case in Africa. I mean, there's, you know, the innate hypocrisy that, you know, African and potentially Middle Eastern leaders are on the table, but obviously, you know, Western American and UK leaders are not on the table, right? So there is that innate power imbalance in terms of applying international law. And then there's the notion that in a lot of conflict zones, will like it or not, we're going to need the participation and buy-in of many people, whether they're national leaders or whether they're rebel groups or whatever, all of whom have almost certainly committed human rights atrocities, into creating some type of durable framework and agreement. So I guess, you know, when it comes to Syria, I guess you're already at a point now where you just think, regardless of any kind of negotiated agreement or diplomatic process, Assad stays in purely because of the imperial patronage of Russia and Iran. But where do you see the kind of larger point of the tension between righting grave wrongs and then the actual nitty-gritty of forming agreements that will include, you know, anybody with blood on their hands? I mean, also, this is, you know, true of any, if an agreement ever happened with Israel and Palestine, that would also be the case, right? Like, you'd have to deal with, okay, like, Hamas is going to be involved, they engage in terrorism. Israeli leader is going to be involved, they almost by definition, at the very least, are, you know, running an apartheid state, if not responsible for egregious war crimes.
Yeah, I think that the difference with the Syrian case is that there's not actually going to be any real agreement. Like, if there was an agreement and there was a real peace deal where they said, okay, you'll make compromises, we'll make compromises, then you can say, okay, you know, for the sake of moving forward, some people with blood in their hands on both sides will have to be accepted, and it's for the greater good. And you've seen that in many conflicts in the past. It's the standard way you move forward from a very brutal civil war. What's happened now is Bashar al-Assad is winning an outright victory, more or less. In the Geneva process, he's not even going to need it in a year or so. The rebels only have, you know, the territories they have are extremely divided. They're all fighting amongst each other. They're extremists who are running it as well. There's no one really who has the ability to negotiate any deal. Bashar al-Assad's won, and he knows that, and he's not, his position's increasing month over month. So, you know, if it was a case where there was a real peace deal, which was made 2-3 years ago, a real deal which actually devolved power in the country and moved forward some democratic process and, you know, had some agreements about prisoners and the tens of thousands of people who disappeared over the past few years, then you could say, well, this is the lesser evil, let's do that. But I just don't think it's going to happen in this case. He's just going to win. And in winning, you know, I was just in Jordan recently, I was in Turkey a few months before that. There's Syrians everywhere, people who are very bitter about what's happened to them. They've lost family, they've had family members who were tortured, raped, they've been driven out of their homes, they've lived in for, families have been there for thousands of years. They are not going to forget what's happened. They're going to implant, you know, seeds of revenge and hatred that are going to blossom for the next generations. So him staying in power, I think it's not a solution either. It's going to be a temporary band-aid on a horrible, grievous wound. And it's going to come back. You know, this is just going to be a breather. When people are exhausted now, when they regain their composure and regain their strength, they're going to start fighting once again. So I think that if there was a real peace deal where things change in Syria, that would be the ideal situation, even if some people responsible for crimes stuck around. But without that, you're definitely going to see more conflict. And I think very unfortunately, we're very quite certain that this is only getting started.
Murtaza Hussein of The Intercept, I always appreciate your perspective. Everybody needs to be reading Murtaza if you want to get a grasp of what's happening around really any version of these issues, from Syria to domestic U.S. politics and civil rights. Thanks so much for your time, Murtaza. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
All right, take care. Okay, everyone, we are going to head into the fun half. Thank you once again to everybody who's joined the Michael Brooks Show, debuting tomorrow, 7 p.m. Patreon.com/TMBS. Patreon.com/TMBS. Very excited to have the brilliant Hannah Guys in studio with me. Become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. Subscribe to the Majority Report on YouTube. Give us an iTunes review. Of course, give the Michael Brooks Show an iTunes review when it drops on iTunes on Wednesday for both public and members. Please do that. We want to spike that up, the public version up the charts. 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. IMs are open. See you in the fun half.
all the time. She said, no, 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 no. Like to speak my mind. She said, no, 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 no. And I know her time's not free. She didn't waste none on me. Situation sad.